From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week, I've chosen three articles that I think are very relevant to our practice. Two of these were large randomized trials presented last week at the ESC meeting, and another one is a very interesting article looking at how we measure left ventricular ejection fraction. So I'm going to start with the Global Leaders Trial. This was a study which evaluated antiplatelet therapy after PCI. The goal of the trial was to evaluate whether 1 month of aspirin plus ticagrelor followed by 23 months of ticagrelor monotherapy, how that fared compared to a year of dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and either clopidogrel or ticagrelor, followed by 1 year of aspirin monotherapy in people who had a biolumus stent. The study was randomized, concealed. The patients had a PCI for either stable or unstable coronary disease, and they were randomized equally. So there were about 16,000 patients. The mean duration of follow-up was 24 months. Average age 65, 23% were female, 26% were diabetic. Radial access was used for the intervention in about 3/4. The primary outcome was all-cause mortality or non-fatal MI, and it occurred in 3.8% of the experimental group compared to 4.4% in the control group. This was not statistically significantly different. If you look at the secondary outcome like all-cause mortality, that was also similar, 2.8% in the experimental group versus 3.2% in control. MI, about 1% in each group. And interesting, the bleeding rate from grade 3 or grade 5 bleeding was 2% in the experimental group and just 2.1% in the control. So the authors concluded that after PCI, 1 month of dual antiplatelet therapy, followed by 23 months just of ticagrelor, was not superior to 12 months of DAPT, followed by 12 months of aspirin monotherapy. And it was interesting, of course, particularly that there was not an excess risk of bleeding in the group that got to dual antiplatelet therapy for an entire year versus just for 1 month. I think the trial continues to illustrate the fact that we're searching for more effective and safer antiplatelet therapies after PCI, and fortunately in this case, a more simplified strategy with just a month of duals and then the newer antiplatelet agent ticagrelor for 23 months was not superior. There was clearly a bit of a trend toward the experimental group, but anytime you enroll this volume of patients and you can't show a significant reduction in risk or improvement in safety, then we have to call the trial negative. Another area that was addressed with a trial is the area of reducing vascular events with aspirin. And this trial called ARRIVE was also presented at the ESC, published in The Lancet. And it was a study to evaluate whether aspirin compared to placebo would reduce risk in patients estimated to have moderate cardiovascular risk over 10 years. As you know, currently aspirin is recommended if the pooled risk equation says a patient's risk is greater than or equal to 10%. Of course, depending on circumstance and whether the patient has any safety issues with aspirin. And this trial really was trying to address the question of whether or not that is safe and is it effective. So it was a randomized trial, again, placebo-controlled, and patients received either 100 milligrams of aspirin or placebo. There were over 12,500 patients enrolled, and they were followed for 5 years. Mean age was 64, 30% were women. They excluded diabetics, and of course, they excluded patients who'd already had a cardiovascular event, like a stroke or an MI, revascularization, a vascular intervention. But they also excluded patients with arrhythmia or congestive heart failure. Now, the baseline estimated risk for this group over a 10-year period was 17%. So you would have estimated at 5 years, perhaps, a risk around 7 or 8%. When they look at the primary endpoint, which was a combination of cardiovascular death, MI, unstable angina, stroke, or TIA, they were similar, 4.3% in the aspirin group, 4.5% in placebo, not statistically meaningful. The primary safety outcome was GI bleeding, and that occurred in about 1% of aspirin group and 0.5% of placebo. So it was a rare complication, but it was twice as common in patients who received aspirin. If you look at the question of MI, 1.4% with aspirin, 1.6% with placebo, and stroke, 1.2% with aspirin, 1.1% with placebo. Neither of these were statistically meaningful. A couple of interesting points from the trial. First of all, it was a well-done trial, very large, 12,500 patients, 5 years of follow-up. Aspirin did not have a highly significant benefit in reducing adverse events. Overall, bleeding events were uncommon, but they were twice as common if the person took aspirin. And the other, of course, take-home message here is the fact that with current preventive therapies, actually this group that was felt to be at moderate risk ended up being at low risk. Their event rate at 5 years was less than 5%. So unfortunately, it did not actually test the original hypothesis, and that is, how does aspirin do in primary prevention in moderate risk patients? These patients actually ended up having lower risk. So I think the take-home message here, there may be a slight signal of reduction in MI, no effect on stroke, and there is an effect on risk for bleeding. So we have to individualize this decision in our patients. Great trial, important trial for primary prevention. The last study I want to talk about today looks at the variability in ejection fraction measured by echo, gated single photon emission computed tomography, and cardiac MRI in patients with coronary disease and LV dysfunction. And this paper was reported this week in JAMA, Open Access. It was an international study looking at LVEF imaging performed at 127 clinical sites in 26 countries from 2002 to 2007. And they were really looking at the correlation of EF in the same patients based on which type of modality the patient actually had. They did a secondary study looking at measurements of LVEF in the STITCH trial, which you may recall was a randomized trial to look at optimal treatment strategy of patients with LVEF of 35% or less and known coronary disease. So the main outcomes, most patients had an echocardiogram, and then subsets of that underwent either SPECT or MR. And the EF was measured by a core lab for each modality independent of the others. So this is analyzing imaging with a very careful methodology. And then the methods were compared. They used moderate statistical analysis to assess this, and then an R value was calculated to see what the correlation was. There were about 2,000 patients in the study, their average age 61. Most of them were male, 85%. The interesting thing, the correlation of LVEF between modalities was 0.6 for echo versus SPECT, about 0.5 for echo versus CMR, and an R value of 0.66 for CMR and SPECT. This suggested that there was only moderate agreement between LVEF measurements from all three core labs and no substantial overestimation or underestimation of LVEF by any modality. That is, there was random scatter. And interestingly, if you ask the question, what percentage of EF determinations fell within 5 percentage points of each other? Actually, it was only from 43 to 54%. Almost half the time, if you compared the EF in the same patient by differing modality, there was a more than 5% EF difference. Now, obviously, this is really something. It highlights the fact that the methods that are used to calculate the EF in these various modalities are vastly different. In particular, echo requires geometric assumptions when we estimate ejection fraction, as one example. Obviously, when there are wall motion abnormalities, that can affect the ability to measure EF. How good are the windows? How good are the pictures, etc.? I certainly think it highlights the point that you and I have to be very careful using a single modality as a single determination of a major intervention, like, for instance, putting in an ICD. One of my big pet peeves has been patients with left bundle branch block, where not infrequently I see drastic differences between EF determined, say, by echo versus a MUGA scan, a multinuclear gated scan. So I think this article is important. It certainly casts some doubt on our ability to confidently measure and report EF, and yet EF is such a strong predictor of risk. I think the article's important to our practice, and for certainly patients on the borderline where an EF measurement is going to make a difference for something that we choose to do or not do, particularly if that may involve risk for the patient. We're wise to get additional studies, validating studies, if you will, to make sure that we're in the right ballpark here. So I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org, and you can find these articles on our website. Please also find a new educational catalog featured on ACC.org. It's located under Education and Meetings tab on ACC.org. You can use this tool, and you can sort the various educational offerings that we have in various formats, and many of those are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And until next week, have a good one. Thank you.